It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Sunday, April 28th, 2024. I'm Jared Halpern. The Supreme Court considers a new precedent of presidential power, criminal immunity.
I think we're at the beginning of litigation that will define that immunity in a real sense, but at least announce what the rule is going to be in general. But the application is still a devil in the details.
And the independent long shot bid of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is a reason for both major candidates to sweat.
RFK Jr. at his core is a left of center, a left of center guy. He should be drawing Democratic votes, but he does speak with a level of authenticity and he speaks with a degree of energy that I think people are willing to give him, at least hear him out.
This is the Fox News Rundown from Washington. A ruling for the ages. That high bar was set by Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch this week as he and the other 8 justices heard about 2 hours of arguments on whether or not former President Trump is immune from prosecution. While the case in front of the court is specific to the special counsel's allegations that former President Trump played a role in the January 6th Capitol riot and attempted to overturn lawful election results, justices appeared to look through a longer lens.
Like Justice Gorsuch, I'm not focused on the here and now of this case. I'm very concerned about the future.
Justice Brett Kavanaugh pressing the Justice Department's attorney over political misconduct by prosecutors and endless court cases for presidential decisions. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson also pressed the attorney for former President Trump about the dangers of a new precedent.
Wouldn't there be a significant risk that future presidents would be emboldened to commit crimes with abandon while they're in office?
Those types of questions suggest justices grappling with how to balance a constitutional theory and practical application. Jim Trusty listened to arguments. He's a former federal prosecutor and previously was an attorney for former President Trump.
I think the advocacy was actually very impressive. I thought both Sauer and Dreeben really displayed an ability to think on their feet with very difficult questions, with real good grasp of history and of some of the philosophical and legal concerns that the court was expressing. So, I start as a guy who was a prosecutor for 27 years, been a lawyer for 35. I enjoy the advocacy no matter kind of where I come out in terms of the arguments. And I disagreed with each lawyer at different junctures, but I thought it was an impressive, kind of conversation, I guess, for lack of a better way to put it.
Yeah, both of them, I should say, did it like with very few notes. It was like extraordinary.
You're seeing it. I mean, like, I've known Mike Dreeben for a long time. I'm not surprised that, he's very adept. But it was interesting. I mean, I think it's breaking down from oral argument, which is not always a perfect bellwether. It seems like it is breaking down on kind of the philosophical lines that you might expect. And I think that the conservative justices, they are looking at history. They're looking at, context, historical context, and thinking about something that's for the ages. I mean, I do think that they made a very conscious decision to not wade into the nitty gritty facts of the current case before them, but to be thinking more about the impact of a decision on immunity. And, I do think this is going to be one for the ages. I think they're going to probably create a form of immunity, not an absolute king can do no wrong. It's not going to be, the president can just run around killing people. But it is going to be something that will basically prevent ambitious prosecutors or unethical prosecutors from running around and taking a political position dressed up as a legal one to go after presidents. What I'm saying, I guess, is I don't think the conservative justices are blind to what's happening in this country right now. I mean, heck, the timing of an Arizona indictment was probably pretty good for that. For them to just basically say, like, we are on a precipice where politicized prosecutions are going to be a real threat. And it's not limited to President Trump. You could see retaliatory stuff that happens for the rest of time. So I think they accurately reflect upon the impact this ruling is going to have. They're going to say that there is some core protection for presidential acts, not personal ones, but presidential ones.
So that seems to me like that's going to be an area where there is a lot of room for maybe vagueness because how do you kind of define strictly what's an official act, what's a personal act? That seemed to be something that they got into with Sauer, with Dreeben a little bit, right? Is if a president does X, is that an official act? Is that an unofficial act? How do you suss that out? How do you kind of draw that bright line?
Yeah, I don't think it's ever going to be that bright. And that's really kind of the crazy part of all this is if they come up with this version of qualified immunity, right, that says, you're absolutely immune if it's within this bubble of, I guess, purely or primarily presidential acts rather than personal ones. They're not going to give like a blow by blow factual account in this ruling of these are things that fit and these are things that don't. So what you're really left with is going back to the trial courts. At least this is my best prediction. You go back to the trial courts where you have preliminary hearings where the judge has to figure out, do I think these fit within a category that I can call presidential, therefore immunized or not? There's a lot of room for mischief there. And the practical reality, I think, is you're going to have litigation like that. It's unclear what the scope is going to be. Do you look at it in terms of when he made a specific phone call? Is that personal? Or do you look at it categorically? Like, this all has to do with election security, or this all has to do with defending the country. And so there's really different lenses that could be used to even do this analysis, which goes to your point about vagueness. And then guess what? We're going to head right back up on appeal to the courts of appeal and to the Supreme Court saying, does this fit that test you announced back in 2024? So I think we're at the beginning of litigation that will define that immunity in a real sense, but at least announce what the rule is going to be in general. But the application is still a devil in the details.
And that devil in the details would be an application for the trial in front of them, right? I mean, it's unclear. I mean, it sounded like there were some concessions that, well, this was a private act, but others were official. And so I guess that the court could like throw that back to the district court and to the appeals court. That would certainly drag out the timeline here of a trial, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I don't think, I mean, for the January 6th prosecution, which is what has led to this particular piece of litigation in the Supreme Court, there's not enough of a record, I don't think, for the Supreme Court to say, and we've looked at this case and here's our conclusion. So I think they're going to announce the test. It's going to go right back to Judge Chutkan. She'll have to figure out, maybe with some guidance from the court, exactly what kind of hearing you have. I mean, I've heard some commentators say that should be left to the jury, which I think would also be incredibly unusual. You know, this is really a legal determination. I don't think it's a jury determination. But there's going to be some chaos, depending on how, clearly they word their opinion when it comes out. But I think it would go back for some form of pretrial hearing that lends itself to further appeals. One party or the other is going to disagree with the result. By the way, in terms of those concessions or non-concessions, keep in mind that, like, when Justice Coney Barrett was pressing Sauer for concessions on what things might be personal or presidential, built into the question was the idea of criminal intent. In other words, she'd say, would you agree, Mr. Sauer, that if a person fraudulently, does this, that, or the other, or with a purpose to obstruct, does this, that, or the other, that would be a personal act? Well, again, that it makes sense to concede that because she's building criminality into the question. And I just don't think it's going to be that clean when you start fighting this out at the trial court level.
And I think we should point out, Sauer sort of suggested that, right? He said, well, I don't agree with the allegations, but broadly speaking,
he didn't fully embrace the premise for sure.
But it was interesting lawyering, and I agree with you. It was really fascinating to see both of these attorneys work, and both of them seemed very comfortable in front of the justices. The justices really seemed like we kind of started out thinking about this in sort of a much larger context. And so that leads me to this question, and that is, I know that the Chief Justice in particular really loathes the idea that this court is viewed through a political lens. He tries to find consensus and maybe a narrower opinion when possible. Do you think there is room here for consensus similar to what we saw in the Colorado case, where ultimately it was 9-0 with justices kind of writing their own kind of concurrences about how they reached that decision?
Yeah, I think it's uphill. I think he should rest on the laurels of the Colorado case. because again, questioning is not a perfect sign. There could be lots of devils that, you know, advocacy taking place where you don't really get a fair read on what the justice is asking or why they're asking it. And there's also the deliberative process. I mean, the justices talk to each other and hash these things out. And so you never know from oral argument with any sort of precision, but I think this is going to break down. I mean, I think what you heard from Sotomayor, Kagan in particular, was an idea that any form of immunity is unprecedented, unsupported, and a terrible idea. That it's going to lead to I forget how one of the justices was phrasing it, but like a criminal nerve center within the presidency. And yeah, I think that's overblown. I mean, but at the same time, they're staking a position that's kind of an absolute position that no immunity should apply at all. I don't think the conservative justices seem to be buying onto that kind of an absolute. And I think one of the reasons why is really worth talking about for a second. You know, when they pressed this idea of what will constrain a president from lawlessness, the response from Mike Dreeben, who I have a lot of respect for, knew him at the Department of Justice, but his response was almost a naive response, I think, in today's world. What he had to say to kind of reassure that even without immunity, presidents will do the right thing is two things. He said, well, they have access to the attorney general. They can get guidance every day of the week from an attorney general as to whether something is lawful or not. And I just don't think that's a particularly realistic model. And it also means then the incentive is get a toady to be your attorney general, get an attorney general who will give you a yes to every question you have, and you'll be covered with essentially immunity. So I don't think that's a particularly attractive model. But the other thing he had to say was that prosecutors should be, you know, that they are expected to act in good faith, that it's against their nature to file political indictments. And I almost think that called for laughter with the Supreme Court. I mean, they didn't laugh, but I think that the notion that all prosecutors are apolitical, I mean, if that was true, then why were people campaigning on an idea that they were going to go after Donald Trump? It's flat out unethical and obviously political. So I do think that the conservative justices are looking at the historical context, they're looking at the Constitution, Article 2, et cetera, but they're also they have to be aware of what's playing out right now and how it endangers the criminal justice system in this country.
A couple of other Supreme Court matters this week that I thought were interesting. I'd love to hear your take on it. I guess let's start with this Idaho abortion case. Really, I think the first major test that this court has had of this sort of post-Roe world, right? Whether or not there is a right to kind of these emergency services that groups argue has been eliminated through this pretty strict abortion law in Idaho. Is this an opportunity, as you see it, for the court to maybe define limits to abortion post-Roe?
It may be an opportunity, but I don't think they're going to jump at that. I mean, I think this really comes down to a pure federalism kind of scenario where the Supreme Court is basically saying, pre-Roe versus Wade, we had a country, a patchwork country, where different states had different concepts of what they could tolerate or not tolerate when it came to abortion. And I think that they feel like they've been able to wash their hands of the issue, and not in a kind of crassly political way, but in a way that dignifies federalism, saying this is something that should be left to each individual state. So I don't know. I mean, I haven't studied this one closely, but I would just say that I think the Supreme Court was loath to revisit anything to do with abortion. But now that they've made this ruling about returning it to the states, I think we're going to see an awful lot of default where they let each state's judicial system iron out what they can tolerate when it comes to the restrictions or exceptions to abortion.
The other interesting case I heard this week was that homeless encampment sort of ban out of Oregon. This idea that cities can have ordinances that, prohibit individuals from sleeping outside in public. And I know there are different ordinances that say different things, but that was sort of the facts of this case in front of the justices. It raised, I thought, some novel questions about kind of do individuals have a right to be homeless, right? Is that something that can be criminalized in the way that some of these communities are trying to deal with a homelessness crisis that certainly raises concerns about crime, raises concerns about cleanliness and other things that municipalities are responsible for curbing, right? Do you see the Supreme Court offering much guidance there, or is that maybe even in your Federalist kind of view, something for states and cities to figure out on their own?
Yeah, that one I think is a closer call, and they may well get involved. I mean, it is really surprisingly challenging, thorny stuff legally when you start talking about, you know, restrictions that Oregon or others are contemplating. And I think it goes to the fact that, you know, there's an old saying, bad facts make bad law. I mean, We've created a society in the last 20 or 30 years that is, I wouldn't say celebratory, but incredibly tolerant of destruction when it comes to people with clear mental health issues, addiction issues, you know, basically tearing down cities with kind of the squalid lifestyle. I mean, I spent a couple of weeks in Los Angeles for a trial last summer, and it was like walking through a minefield of craziness and human feces and all sorts of things just to go from my hotel to the court. And, you know, that was just the lawyers I was seeing, though. Sorry, terrible joke. But, you know, I just don't know that it is a local problem, but it implicates basic fundamental rights. And I think that what we're stuck with is a situation where homelessness and mental health are spiraling in big cities. So it's a local problem, but it does touch upon some federal interests. So they may weigh in. They may talk about, you know, the responsibility of local governments to safeguard its citizens, and they may end up being comfortable with some laws. But I don't think any of this really addresses the severe mental health issues that are underlying all of this and that are creating such horrible zones within a lot of our cities.
Yeah. And that sort of came up in arguments, right? This is sort of a policy prescription, maybe not a Supreme Court prescription.
Yeah, I think that's a fair way to look at it.
All right. Listen, there was a lot happening in the federal judiciary this week. Really appreciate your analysis, helping us sort of understand this better. It'll be fascinating to see how the Supreme Court ends up ruling on these cases over the next several weeks. We'll talk to you, I'm sure, between now and then. Jim Trusty, always appreciate the time, and thanks for the chat.
No, happy to do it. Talk soon.
Pull up a chair and join me, Rachel Campos Duffy.
And me, former U.S. Congressman Sean Duffy, as we share our perspective on the discussions happening at kitchen tables across America.
Download From the Kitchen Table, The Duffys, at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you download podcasts.
"10% is far from the support you need to win the presidency, but it could be more than enough to decide a presidential race. And that could be worrisome for the campaigns of both President Biden and former President Trump when it comes to Democrat-turned-independent Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Kennedy is still fighting for ballot access in most states, but state officials in Michigan say he's qualified there, putting him on the ballot in a state that could come down like it did 4 years ago to about 3 percentage points. Michigan was even tighter in 2016, decided by just more than 10,000 votes. A super PAC aligned with the Kennedy campaign also believes they have the signatures to gain ballot access in other swing states like Arizona, Georgia, Nevada, and North Carolina. And if support for the independent candidate grows, he could also qualify for the national debate stage this fall. So while Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is not yet anywhere near besting the current or former president in an election, He certainly is positioned to play a big role in the presidential race. I talked about that and how each campaign is responding to this new campaign threat with Colin Reed, a Republican strategist, former campaign manager, and co-founder of South and Hill Strategies.
We're seeing it not only in the polling data, where we're seeing some counterintuitive support for RFK Jr., but also by virtue of the fact that poll after poll after poll shows the American voters at least interested or open to the idea of a candidate beyond the two that before them. So it's a really unique set of circumstances, and trying to predict its outcome is really challenging. The big unknown remains ballot access. And I think there's only two states, Michigan and Utah, that RFK Jr. is on the ballot. Accessing ballots is an extremely arduous, challenging, labor-intensive effort. And if he can't get his name on the ballot, all of this is a moot point.
You know, it's interesting that you sort of say both sides kind of have some concerns, and it's kind of counterintuitive. I suppose that's because some sort of just a name standpoint, the Kennedy name, that attracts an awful lot of maybe initial interest from Democrats, and then as people maybe dive a little bit more into his policy prescriptions, it's got more of maybe a populist bend to it, and that attracts more of the Trump folks?
Yeah, look, I come from the Northeast. I come from New England, where the Kennedy name, even though there's fewer of them in elected office now, if any, than there were at one time, but the name still carries cachet with a select certain amount of voters. And don't forget, he is the nephew of John F. Kennedy. He is the son of RFK, who was a rising star in his own right. And he's got immediate recognizable name ID among Democratic voters. It would be as if a Bush got into the race on the Republican side. You're automatically, by virtue of your last name, you've got a ticket to entry. So there's a select few who, even before they understand his views or understand what he believes, are going to be drawn to the idea of his candidacy. The other thing I'd say, my old boss, Scott Brown, up in New Hampshire, he hosted all the candidates that were willing to come through at his house for a town hall meeting in New Hampshire in the months leading up to the primary. All the Republican candidates, save Trump, showed up. And RFK Jr. also showed up, and he was the one who by far and away had the largest crowd. And it wasn't just Democrats. There was a lot of Republicans. There were a lot of conservatives willing to give the guy a look. So I don't think his presence can be completely discounted as it impacts the next few months.
Nobody, at least that we've heard, at least the prominent members of his family, have endorsed his candidacy. In fact, there was a big event this week for sort of the Kennedys for Biden, right? That's, I don't know, is that going to make, I guess that makes Thanksgiving awkward, but I don't know what that says kind of about his appeal.
Yeah, look, it's a tricky dynamic. You know, I think no one, wherever your station in life, no one likes being at odds with your family members, but he's handled it with grace. He hasn't taken the bait, and he's taken the high road. And the Kennedys are loyal partisan Democrats, if nothing else, absent RFK Jr., who's charting his own course here. So I think you can expect more of that. But ultimately, voters are going to be drawn to the guy or not drawn to the guy based on what he's doing, his message, his positions. Look, him getting onto the Michigan ballot is seismic. Michigan in 2016 was decided by 11,000 votes. And he's on the ballot there, and it's got 16 electoral votes. It's one of those big three in the so-called blue wall that came crashing down that elected Donald Trump. So if he's on that ballot and he's up there working hard and he's taking votes from both sides, it's going to make both sides sweat.
So that's really hitting the nail on the head, I think, right? Because that makes RFK Jr. A spoiler. That's an unusual role for a presidential candidate. You know, even I guess the high watermark for an independent candidate, kind of in the way we think about it now, is Ross Perot. He only ran because he was on the ballot in all 50 states. He seemed to be kind of weary of being that spoiler role. Now, obviously, we can go back and look at whether or not he was. But, you know, what's the campaign strategy if you're RFK Jr. and you are not able to get on the ballot in a majority of states or all states or enough states to win 270 or whatever it is?
Well, right. No one gets into a race with the idea that they're not going to win. So if he can't do that, he's going to have to find a new rationale for being in the race. Running for office is not fun. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of time away from your family. It can be a financial drain. So you got to have a reason to get out of bed in the morning. that's pretty clear and unable to understand. Otherwise, you're quickly going to run out of steam. But some of the other states he's hovering around the hoop on are Arizona, Georgia, Nevada, North Carolina. Mm-hmm. These are states where he has intimated or suggested that he may be on the ballot. Election officials haven't confirmed that yet, but all four of those states I mentioned, Jared, they're also could potentially be jump ball states. So if his name is on the states that are going to determine this election, and it really will come down to 5, 6, maybe 7 states, and he's on all those, he's going to have a role to play. And look, before he became associated with some of the people on the right who had different views on the role of the COVID vaccine, mm-hmm. and et cetera, RFK Jr. was known as an environmental lawyer mm-hmm. who just waged war on America's energy industry. He's gotten into hot water for supporting a fracking ban, maybe not supporting a fracking ban anymore. It's the same issue that bedeviled then-candidate John Fetterman when he was running for Senate in Pennsylvania, and he eventually came around and said, no, actually, I'm not for a fracking ban because, you know, well, I don't know why, but it supports a lot of jobs and industry in his state. So look, RFK Jr. at his core is a left of center, a left of center guy. Mm-hmm. He should be drawing Democratic votes, but he does speak with a level of authenticity and he speaks with a degree of energy that I think people are willing to give him, at least hear him out, because frankly, there are no other options. It's pretty clear that the voting public is not thrilled with the two options they have. So by virtue of anybody else being there, they're going to at least get a look.
So I think you kind of got to where I was going to ask you, and that is, if both campaigns are kind of sweating this, they're probably going to play active roles in trying to dissuade their supporters from voting for Robert F. Kennedy Jr. I guess that environmental policy is what we're going to see maybe from Trump-affiliated groups, and what some of the COVID stuff and other maybe more controversial issues that he's talked about publicly comes from the Biden side.
Well, if you listen from the Biden side, I think you're going to continue to see them trot out various members of the Kennedy family to announce their support for President Biden. I think on the Trump side, you have and you'll continue to see them start to litigate some of these issues that I got at in terms of energy, mm-hmm. The environment, and where he has views that are far out far outside the mainstream as far as some of these voters who are considering voting for him are concerned. Like the Joe Rogan type listeners are not going to have a lot to like in some of the things that RFK Jr. has said and done over the years. That being said, when you listen to him, when you talk to him, he doesn't lean into the vaccine issue. That's what he's become most closely identified with. It's a loser with him, not because of the COVID vaccine, set that aside for a minute, but some of the views he's had on other vaccines. And that's where he starts to lose a lot of people and sound a little bit outside the mainstream. But I would expect the Biden folks to make this more about the Kennedy family and also the threat for Trump. And that kind of gets back to the entire rationale for the Biden candidacy. He's not out there talking about the reasons people should elect him as much as he's talking about reasons that people shouldn't elect President Trump and the fear-mongering and the scare tactics that go into it. But look, GDP numbers missing the mark by such a wide margin. Inflation continues to stick around. I do think you're going to have to, if you're the Biden campaign, you're going to have to start getting into some pro-Biden messaging at some point, because we've seen that it's not just enough to fillet and torch the other person as being totally unelectable. You got to give voters something to chew on that you're going to do as well.
Let me finish with this, just because it's obviously been something we've been following all week, and that is what's been happening in New York City, this trial of the former president, the hush money payments. You know, it's interesting that there's no cameras, right? We're not seeing this. And, you know, I was thinking sort of about it, obviously, given the events over the last couple of weeks, the OJ trial, right, where we saw every single second of it. And I wonder if not seeing the sort of minute by minute, play by play has as big an impact on the electorate as maybe it otherwise would. Does the trial, as we're seeing it unfold here in New York, impact the campaign one way or another?
Look, the trial has put Donald Trump front and center, cable news, headlines, you name it, even though he can't theoretically campaign, he's just everywhere. And that has shifted the dynamics of this race. And it's taken the attention off Joe Biden. So as it relates to what's being discussed and the contents of the trial, I think Donald Trump's whatever people have made up their mind on him one way or another. I'm not sure there's much new information that could come out that would persuade someone to like or not like him. The bigger issue that happened this week, in addition to the trial, is what's going on in the world right now, especially at these college campuses, what's happening overseas. There is just this feeling that everything is amiss. The world is asunder. Everything's going in the wrong direction, and voters tend to punish the person who's in charge. Right now, that's Joe Biden. And that's if I'm the Biden campaign, that's what's keeping me up at night. Bill Clinton had this famous saying that during times of peril, voters will take wrong and strong over weak and right every time. And Joe Biden is not going to win a contest of who's stronger against Donald Trump. And that's, to me, the biggest vulnerability of what's going on, especially at these college campuses, especially what Joe Biden said earlier in the week, seeming to equate what some of these pro-terrorist groups are saying with what's happening in Israel. So he's got a real problem on his hands. He better get a hold of it quickly, or just like in 2020, when the COVID virus felt like it was sending everything spinning apart and Donald Trump was at the helm, Joe Biden could be brought down by the same sort of political phenomenon.
It'll be a lot to watch as we get closer to the summer months and really when a lot of these campaigns kind of begin in earnest, although we're certainly in general election mode right now, aren't we? So we'll have a lot more of these conversations. Colin Reed, always appreciate the time. Have a good weekend.
Thank you, Jared. You too.
That will do it for this edition of the Fox News Rundown from Washington podcast. Tomorrow, Florida Republican Congressman Mike Waltz joins the Fox News Rundown to talk about tensions with China and the possibility TikTok could be banned for millions of Americans. Until then, thanks for listening. I'm Jared Halpern from Washington.
Stay up to date by subscribing to this podcast at foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen ad-free on Fox News Podcasts Plus on Apple Podcasts. And Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on Amazon Music. And for up-to-the-minute news, go to foxnews.com.
This is Jimmy Failla, inviting you to join me for Fox Across America, where we'll discuss every single one of the Democrats' dumb ideas. Just kidding. It's only a 3-hour show. Listen live at noon Eastern or get the podcast at foxacrossamerica.com.